accession number 20259, reel 3.
Hey.
Yep.
Jim Burns, reel 3.
Yep. We became a mechanized battalion, and we got issued. The battalion got issued with 3 tonners, 1,500 weights, jeeps, and the thing was from Chiselden Camp. It was full-time training down to, used to be a little place called Ogbon St. George. We used to go down there training, but then we'd do 6 and 8 weeks training down on Salisbury Plain. And that was the first time that I ever saw, I'd heard of a place called Princetown, and that was, it was only when we went down there in March 2 that I found out it was a prison. It was Princetown, and it's right on the main street. And also down there is one of our, the Army's famous glass houses called Shepton Mallet. And I only had one time to go down there as an escort to take a prisoner down to Shepton Mallet. And it was, well, we were stationed at Chiselden, and the whole battalion was going on leave because we were on duty, we were going on embarkation leave to go to Germany. And on the day of the passage going out, the sergeant major called me over and said, "I'm sorry, but you got an escort duty to take a prisoner down to Salisbury Plain, to Shepton Mallet." He said, "Your pass will be held here." He said, "When you get back, you can pick your pass up and go." He said, what we'll do, he said, "We'll give you an extra day on from the thing." So we went down to Shepton Mallet. It was chucking it down. There was nobody at the railway station to meet us. Of course, in them times, when you escorted a prisoner down, you had to be handcuffed to them all the time, even on the train. So the idea was that you'd let the train know that you were coming, and they'd keep your seat in the corner, just in the entrance of a carriage. And you'd sit down and you'd throw your overcoat over the hands that have got the handcuff to whichever one you were passing to. And, of course, we get out of the train at Shepton Mallet, nobody there, chucking it down. And the station master there says, "Oh, I don't think you'll get a wagon to come out in this lot." He said, "You'll have to march down there." So he told us the direction to go. And when we saw it, you know, it was a real sort of quiet but foreboding, you know, it was all brick, and it was kind of rounded, and every so often in the wall was a little door where we were going round looking for the gate, because it was one of these sort of doors we kept banging on. Anyway, in time somebody opened one of them and shouted out, "Oi, escort witness accused this way," you know. So we marched in there, and we had to march as if we were the prisoners. And all the sort of wardens in charge, and all in uniform, and all carrying the little sticks and one thing and another, and left, right, and stop, stay, and this, that, and the other. Then the prisoner had to kind of strip down, because he had to go and have a shower first before the medical officer come to examine him and see that he was fit to do the sentence. I mean, if a person was ill, they wouldn't put him in to do the thing. He'd go into a hospital or somewhere. But anyway, we got in there, and then we have to go through all his kit. Everything's got to be marked out, one thing or another. Then when all that's done, then he'll sign your one prison, one body, fit, and all this, that, and the other sign thing, and then march out and go back and get your train and back to camp. But, I'd never been in sort of prison or things like that, you know. I've been in my local guardhouse sort of thing, you know, for a couple of days. Maybe been drunk and disorderly or some time or other. But I wouldn't want to go in one of those things.
Why?
And, they own you. You do whatever they tell you to do and one thing or another. I don't know what sort of degree of force they could use or things like that, but people who have been in and come out of there said, never again, you know. But
did you go to Germany?
Yes. We went to a place called Minden, near Hanover. And Germany at that time was still occupational forces that were occupying it. So you weren't allowed any civilian clothes. It was all uniform. There was no Berlin Wall. There was nothing like that. We used to, the Russians used to come over into Berlin and mix with the guards. They didn't move any further away from Berlin, because at that time we had a prison called Spandau, and there were seven prisoners in that prison. The most famous one, the last one, was Hess, but there were two admirals, Admiral Dönitz and Admiral Radar, who was the deputy Führer at the end of the war, was Radar. There was Hitler's architect, Speer, and two other little sort of Germans, which I can't recall the names, but as I say, there were seven altogether, and over the years it kind of released them and things. But the thing was, we, in Germany, as I say, we were occupation forces, and you had to stay in your own area. And the way you knew your area, because the MPs were patrolling around and the civilian police, but civilian police couldn't really do anything with it, you know, for military, with military people, you know, because, I mean, we were there to supervise them as well, I suppose. But you had your divisional flash on your arm, and as was the iron fist sort of thing, which meant that our area was Westphalia, that sort of thing. If you were in Berlin, you got a different sort of flash. If you were somewhere else, you got a different flash. But the only times that you come out of your area were when you used to do guards, because the guards on Spandau used to run in French, British, American and Russian, which are the four occupational powers. And of course, Berlin on that side have got checkpoints. The famous one, or it's called the famous one, Checkpoint Charlie, because that was the American one, and that was because it had the bridge, you see. So everybody knows about Checkpoint Charlie. Checkpoint Alpha was the British sector, so we had the train that went through into East Berlin, sort of thing. So if you want to go to East Berlin by train, you come through the British sector. The other two, B and D, was French and whoever the other one was.
Russian, maybe.
Yeah. And, because, well, the bridge, actually, the D, the Russian side, is the opposite end to C, because that was the bridge. That's halfway across there is where they'd done the exchange of prisoners, you know, or whoever, you know, they picked up or something, you know, deserters or things like that. But
did you stand guard at Spandau?
Yes, yeah, you do the guards at Spandau, and there's, of course, you read all the rules and you do it, and it's a sort of thing. You don't discuss what the rules are and what happens in there or anything like that. You just do your things. But it was an uneasy time in Germany, because the atomic kind of war thing was all building up. And, you know, like the tanks were going to get atomic shells and things like that. There was also a kind of, everybody used to be out on the booze sort of thing, you know, the boredom of it. And I know we used to give a battalion a break, you used to go on exercises, you know. Well, I mean, the army lads don't want to go on exercises, eating bully beef and this, that and the other. But in Germany, it was a welcome break, and we used to go to two places. One was Zennerlager, and one was Putlos. And Zennerlager, actually, is where Rommel trained his troops. So, of course, they had all sort of real sort of obstacles to come up against and sort of things, you know, for ground troops or tanks or sort of things, real hard, sort of get yourself over there or you're dead kind of thing, you know. And they said that's how Rommel got his crack troops, with the discipline and what they had to go through at Zennerlager. and Putlos. And by that time, I had transferred out from a rifle company into support company, because in Germany we'd also got issued with universal carriers, which were for Vickers machine guns, and Oxford carriers, which was for the 3-inch mortars. And the support company consists of Vickers machine guns, 3-inch mortars, 25-pound anti-tanks, and assault pioneers. And that was support company, special group.
What did you go into?
Into the Vickers. Into the Vickers machine guns.
How did you like doing that?
Great. It was great. Yeah, it was a good weapon. And, you know, in the time that I was in the army, of course, the Vickers was written off at the end. And yet it was the best gun out of all the other ones there. The only trouble with it, it could not be converted to take the new 7.62 ammunition. Because the old Vickers, how it had been built and one thing, that was the old 303 with the rim on, which could whip the cartridges out, sort of thing, you know. And it couldn't be converted to that. The breeze block and the lock was made just for that sort of ammunition. It couldn't be converted to anything else. And yet, it was a machine gun at the time. It was better than all the other NATO ones. It was better than the Brown and the American sort of guns, because the American, these other ones were air cooled. And of course, if you fired it rapid for so long, you'd done the barrels in. Well, it was with a Vickers, it was water cooled. And of course, you carried two or three barrels with it, because it was so accurate that you could use the Vickers machine gun to give covering fire to a patrol or a unit going in with fixed bayonets or whatever that. You could fire to within 3 degrees safety on that, you know, with the barrel. If you got a barrel that had got so many thousands of rounds through it, of course, well, the more rounds that goes through it, it's taking the rifling out. So when the bullet leaves a warm barrel, it's spinning off at a bigger angle. See, whereas a new barrel, you can give a 3 degree safety fire over your troops, so you can lay down a rough fire in front of them so they can get near to trenchways or whatever they want to do. And it was a battalion that, if you were in support company, you were kind of the elite, because you were the heavy sort of things for the infantry. You're no longer going to be a fellow with a rifle down the front. But having said that, then there comes a time when you do have to go back into sort of thing, but you know the training and everything, so it's not there.
How did you get on with the Germans?
Well, it wasn't so bad. The place we were in, Minden, was actually noted for being a strong sort of Nazi sort of following, you know, when Hitler and Gore and all the people used to be on there, that, you know, coming to, they really get out and you know, greet themselves. And they didn't. But the thing was, hardly any of the Germans spoke English, and hardly any of us spoke German, sort of thing. I mean, we knew how to go down to a bar and order a beer, which the barman could speak English well enough, but pretend he didn't know, and sort of thing. Because the thing is, we got paid in what they called BAF, which was occupational money. We got paid in BAF, which was a sixpenny, a threepenny note, a sixpenny note, a five pence or shilling note, a 2 and 6 note, a 5 shilling note, a 10 shilling note, and a pound. But then you were allowed to change, I think, about £1.50 into marks at the pay table. You could buy marks somewhere else if you got stuff to barter with, you know. And sort of we get the marks, and the idea was you only got so much, because they didn't want you to keep going down to the pub and getting, you know, knocking back and fighting with the Germans, because I don't know why there's always something starts an argument somewhere. And it seems to be that you're continually on parade the next day, identification parade, you know, and you're all lined up there, and of course the German broken, wounded, come in and whatnot, and go through the ranks and tap you on the shoulder if you think you were the one who started the fight or whatever it is, or broke the chair in the pub or things like that. And then they go away. But in actual fact, I mean, what you got was something like an extra guard or compound to barracks for 2 or 3 days or something like that. It was a sort of, you know, I think the people, the generals and the COs and the people at the top knew what can we do to keep them occupied all the time that we're in there, you know, in the occupation zone. What can we do? And of course the Russians play up and sort of things as soon as something's happening down there, you know, everybody else is, you know, waiting. And I know we have boxing matches and we'll fight the Black Watch and this, that and the other, but it didn't seem to, you know, the unease that was hanging about there. And of course you're in uniform all the time and said, oh, you know, we're going to get back to Blighty and get some leave or things like that, you know, girlfriends and sort of things. And the company said, oh, I mean, all you could do is go to the Naffy and get beer, except if you were a corporal, you could get a whiskey as well, because it was kind of duty-free over there, sort of thing, you know. But you go down to town and you can get a bottle of snaps for the same price as a bottle of beer in the Naffy.
Were you ever in any fights yourself with Germans?
Well, we're saying fights, it's kind of, you know, they'll push you and you push them and then somebody will let a fist fly and something like that, and they kind of half a dozen lads will be in and pull you off and, you know, just that sort of thing. It just depends on who's been, you know, sworn at first or something like that, you know. But I think on a whole, the Germans kind of, they'd lost the war, and they've got these young coming soldiers coming in, you know, coming down to the pub and one thing and that. They want a lot of fraternising with the girls, with the Fräuleins. For some reason or other, you know, they kind of kept out of the way. The people who used to go up the bar are the old sort of Germans and sort of things. And you'd hear them, you'd be sitting there drinking a beer and one thing. And well, the barman had always been exploited is because what they do, they get all these glasses out, you go in there and you'd ask for a pint of beer, which being English, you ask for a pint of beer, but you get these little glasses, and he fills about a dozen of them, and it's a little bit of beer in the bottom, and the rest is prof. Well, he's got to leave it there for a bit, put it to settle down, and you're leaning there on the counter waiting, then he'd give them all another little drop, and he'd get his little wooden scoop, and take the top off, and wait, and then what he used to do, he'd get the snaps bowl and put it on the table, on the counter next, you know, waiting. Well, it costs you twice as much for the snaps as it does for a beer. Because if you're sitting there waiting about a quarter of an hour's gone on, and they're only just coming up to somewhere near the top, so, oh, give us a bloody snap. So he'd have the glasses already out on a little board like, which I have here, because I go to the German club, it's like a handle with holes in them, and I've got all the glasses, and all you do is just go like that with a bottle of snaps and fill them up and hand it to the lads. Of course, you paid for them straight away for it, waiting that. And by the time he'd had a couple of snaps, he'd managed to get the glass spilled. Well, of course, you've got that, but in the meantime, if you're taking your beer and you've taken other snaps with you, he's already filling up the next lot, because we've told him, you know, keep it going, you know, sort of thing, and it goes on like that. And the arguments then start, I paid for that one last time. Oh, no, sort of things like that. But of course, the barman knew what was what, and he'd say, right, you know, if he wanted it quiet, he'd say, right, you can have those, no more, sort of thing, you know. And they always seem to be able to call on the police. Now, the police weren't very happy to come in. What they would rather do is call in the military police. But as long as they want no fighting or anything, the military police didn't really want to come in. If you were arguing about a price or something, that's between you and that landlord. You know, it was nothing to do with them. And the German police were of the same sort of thing, you know. Well, we try and call the military police, and no, they don't want to know. Well, we can't do anything, you know, the occupational troops. We can't arrest them, only military police can do that.
So the fights didn't start over the war?
No. No, there's the only time that I used to think about war, we used to have some of the lads would pick up some sort of words in German and sort of thing, and come in and say something like, you know, deuce kankity cop, you know, soft in the head and things like that, and of course they'd react to it, you know, but more times than not, it's only the, like, the hot-headed Germans and the hot-headed bloody English that the fight really went, but there'd be a lot of shouting and swearing, and the Germans had kind of got an aggressive sort of, I mean, the play cards on the table, you know, well, we play cards, you know, and we turn around, but when they play cards, they really slam the cards down and bang the table with the knuckles, you know, boom, and thing, and you think, oh, you know, coming sports, sport. But it's not, that's the way they play their cards. You know, I mean, you know, I'll beat you sort of thing, you know. And,
yeah. How did you get your posting to Korea?
It was coming up, I think it was all, it kind of a rumour went round that the battalion was going to be on the move somewhere, but we didn't really know where. It could have been that we were moving somewhere else in Germany, because there was a lot of sort of trouble coming up on the border at Berlin. As I say, you know, the atomic sort of thing was coming up. I know that from our own battalion, we'd picked up a Russian from somewhere, or he'd crossed over the border and managed to get down to our sort of area. And they put him in our jailhouse, and I think he was in there for about a day, but it was supposed to be a hush-hush job. And, of course, they got all what they wanted to know about him, and this, that, and the other. And the next time that we found out anything that was happening was when the military police came and collected him up, and they took him back to the border. Well, there was a lot of rumours going on about what happened and sort of thing. But it was still sort of military, it was military rule there. I mean, we even had firing squad training, you know, for different things. There was a sergeant, can't remember his regiment, but he'd murdered this other sergeant, swung him off the balcony with a rope round his neck because he was having an affair with his wife. And the hangman, Mr. Piersman, somebody, Pierpont, was coming over to Germany to do the necessary jobs, you know. But the firing squad was all on standby, sort of thing, you know. You had to go training, you know, for firing squad and things. But then, of course, we were up ready to, we then found out where we were going, you know. We're on the way to Korea. We're going back, we're going to Blighty, we're going to Pontefract. And, of course, we got all our kit that we needed in Germany, but then the CO decided that we would march from Minden to Hook of Holland, because we used to go by boat in those days, Harwich, Hook of Holland, the boat, and actually I used to come on leave, Harwich, Hook of Holland, and we'd march, and of course we got the medics with us and one thing another, you know, and stop, have your iron rations and one thing another, and rest and sort of things, and as I say, we've got all our gear, because all our equipment, all the first line equipment was already in Germany, it's all in storage areas and sort of thing, because we were actually using it, you know. So we went to Pontefract, and it was only to go there to kind of get everybody documented and give you some leave so you could go and see your wives and families and girlfriends and sort of things, and because it was the usual sort of things. The poor old recruits at Pontefract, because it was a recruitment area, you know, doing all the drills and, you know, being there about 2 or 3 weeks. Well, of course, they got all these lot come out from Germany and down the pub and eating fish and chips. But the thing was, you know, the Bugler go for cookhouse, and because it was an old-fashioned sort of cookhouse. You got your meth tins, and you know, going across there. Because the poor old recruits are training up and down on the square, and all the lads are just walking straight across. And the sergeant's in charge. They only looked about 15 years old, and they're saying, "Get up my square," and all this, that, and the other. And the lads just saying, "What do you mean?" You know, giving them all this, that, and the other. Because somebody, the rumour went round, if you don't want to go to Korea, get yourself thrown in the jailhouse. But they wouldn't have any of that. They wouldn't have any of that. No. No, the sergeant just had to kind of stand on one side and let all these louts and whatnots go into the cookout sort of thing. But
did you want to go to Korea?
Well, I don't know. I didn't fancy going over there and fighting the Chinese, because I thought, you know, because we associated them the same way as the Japanese. You know, the Japanese and the Chinese. And the thing was that the Japanese had already used to occupy China in the first place, so they learnt everything from them, didn't they? So we're going on, you know, there was all kind of things. But at the same time, we were going to move overseas to another posting, and the, you know, it was all kamikaze and sort of things, you know. We'd get out there, and of course we got other regiments that had gone. And because one of the regiments that had gone before us was the Black Watch, and it was they let it be known in the battalion that because Black Watch has kind of been over the centuries been our sister regiment, the Duke of Wellington's and the Black Watch regiment, and the Black Watch and the Duke of Wellington's were in Korea before in the Crimea, had been stationed in Korea, in the Crimean War, so that you know, it's a kind of history repeats itself. So that was the kind of the battalion sort of pep talk, you know, that the Dukes had already been out there and they acquitted themselves quite well under Wellington and sort of things, and we're kind of going back to sort out what's going on with these fellas at the other side that want to take over.
How did you get out there?
We went from Liverpool on the Devonshire, and she was a big top-heavy ship, and it was all hammocks. So we get on this boat, and because we've got so many naval personnel, because it's troop ships. But we had a lot of all the other people on the boat were kind of Malaccan and Indians and sort of things like that. But we had a ship's RSM, and he was there to kind of, not so much to keep order, but having that many troops on there, it's got to be run, you know, to strict sort of rules. As I say, it was all hammocks, so the hammocks had to be strung up at night time, and they're over the mess tables. There was, say, 8 people to a mess table. Well, 2 of those people used to have to go to the cookhouse, to the galley, with a couple of Dixies and get the food, which seemed to be a lot of cheese, boiled fish, you know, easy sort of things that to be prepared. No pies cooked or things like that, you know, it was all this sort of thing that could do potato and things. And sort of come down to the mess, because you couldn't all go to the galley. And you couldn't all come back and start sitting down and sitting. That's why you only had 2 up each table. And yet, then you couldn't go until the 8 people was there. So if there was one somewhere else on the boat, or down the loos or something, you had to wait while they come back. Which they don't call them loos on ships, they call them heads. And and of course, you put your hammocks up, then the next morning they all had to be taken down, and they had to be strung up into 8 rings of rope, and then they're put into a cradle. And of course, you've got your name tag on your one. Well, a lot of the blokes used to have your hammocks and all your personal gear and one thing and another instead of being in your kit bag, because you had a sea kit bag and a kit bag you took with you. So you put all your stuff in your hammock and lashed it up, put it in there, and that was as safe as anywhere, because the only person who'd get yours out at night time would be yourself, you know, to string it up. And we left there, and it took us between